Previously on Beta.
Happy! 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 Happy!
No one talks about the body hair. I came here to tell you about it.
What is this place?
Duh, it's obviously an underground city where the last remaining humans live and the robots are coming to kill us. Doesn't that just make you want to party?
Yeah!
I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, we welcome stand-up comedian Zainab Johnson.
You're either like me, and you're going to identify with who I am because I'm a reflection of you, or I'm completely different, and you are going to enjoy the journey of exploring somebody else.
And a little later, we'll get to know one of country music's greatest historians, Wisconsin's Bill Malone.
I like to think that the music my mother sang was country music. She didn't know where it came from. Some of it came from the church. She was an ardent Pentecostal, and she poured out her heart in music.
Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
Do you want to know what it is?
That's a clip from the sci-fi thriller The Matrix, starring Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne. It was released in 1999. 20 years later, we are still under the influence of The Matrix. So says journalist Mark Harris. His New York Magazine cover story is called The Matrix Built Our Reality-Denying World. Mark, welcome to Beta. In your piece, you say that The Matrix is omnipresent. What do you mean by that?
You know, with other big movie franchises like, say, Star Wars or Star Trek, the way we talk about them is we talk about them, we talk about the characters, we talk about the reboots, we talk about the situations. The Matrix has had a more kind of insidious, secret effect on our culture. It's not that we talk about the movie so much, it's that we use its language. The whole premise of The Matrix, which is that reality is this illusion that is right in front of your eyes, and if you want to see the real reality, you just need to kind of come out of your slumber and be reborn into it. That's the kind of cultural reach that The Matrix has had in the way we talk about things now, that we don't even know it's about The Matrix. When we talk about what if we're all living in a broken simulation, or when people on the internet or on Reddit forums say, take the red pill, which is a line that comes from the original Matrix, which sort of means wake up. Or even when you see a headline like, you've been doing such and such wrong your whole life, as if life is this kind of enigma that you just have to wake up in order to decode. That's all kind of the world that The Matrix helped build.
Yeah. Why do you think that the Matrix doesn't get the same kind of love and devotion that Star Wars and Harry Potter do?
For one thing, The Matrix always had a more limited audience than those other franchises. It was not a movie for kids. In fact, although a lot of kids, of course, saw it, in fact, it was one of the first R-rated action blockbusters ever to really have huge impact at the box office. I think another issue with The Matrix is a pretty simple one, which is that people didn't really like the sequels. They were made back-to-back. They came out in the same year, a couple of years later. And, you know, the second Matrix movie is actually by far the highest grossing of the three. That's really a tribute to how popular the first one was and how it grew and grew and grew after its initial release. The third Matrix movie is by far the lowest grossing of the three, and that is a statement about how little people liked the second movie.
Yeah, clearly.
So I think when something, you know, when something doesn't stick the landing necessarily in terms of becoming a franchise, that can kind of pull it out of the long-term popular conversation a little bit.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what The Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
Can you give us kind of a brief synopsis of the plot?
Sure. And the funny thing is, The Matrix itself kind of gives people a brief synopsis of its plot right at the beginning. It's the movie's about 2 hours and 10 minutes, and in a way, the first 45 minutes are setting up the terms for the action movie that then follows. And what it basically is the story of Neo, who's played by Keanu Reeves, who's a kind of drudge. He's a computer guy, but he's sort of a low-level, you know, worker ant. And he is kind of inducted into the mysteries of the Matrix by two characters, Trinity and Morpheus. Morpheus is Lawrence Fishburne's character, and Morpheus explains to him,
"The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room, you can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth."
"What truth?"
"That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind."
The story of The Matrix is partly the story of Neo being reborn, literally in the movie, into the real world. And then the other story of The Matrix is that it's kind of a fun heist slash chase movie, like an Ocean's 11 movie or a Mission Impossible movie. But that kicks in once you are told the premise of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. How much of a debt, if any, do you think The Matrix owes to John Carpenter's 1988 film, They Live? Because in that film, it's kind of the same idea, seeing behind the reality, because there's this drifter, played by my fellow Canadian, the wrestler Rowdy Roddy Piper, and he discovers that the ruling class are made up of aliens who are keeping their real appearance hidden, and they're using mass media subliminal messages to manipulate people to spend money, breed, and accept the status quo. Do you think the Wachowskis went to school on that film at all?
I think it's certainly possible. I don't know enough detail about what their thinking was to know if They Live was a specific influence, but I do know that they were very effective. They are very effective pop culture scavengers. I mean, when I rewatched The Matrix recently after 20 years, the thing I really noticed that surprised me was the influence of the Terminator movies. Mm. That, you know, those were the big kind of prevailing sci-fi dystopian fantasy for about, you know, 10 or 12 years before The Matrix came along. And there is actual language in the dialogue of The Matrix that sort of almost makes it a companion piece to the Terminator movies.
"We have only bits and pieces of information, but what we know for certain is that at some point in the early 21st century, all of mankind was united in celebration. We marveled at our own magnificence as we gave birth to AI.
AI? You mean artificial intelligence?
A singular consciousness that spawned an entire race of machines. We don't know who struck first, us or them, but we know that it was us that scorched the sky."
I mean, that's pretty much taking the world building of the Terminator and using it for new means. And the other thing I think was a very visible influence on The Matrix wasn't a movie, but a TV show, The X-Files. Mm. I think for several years, by the time The Matrix came out, The X-Files had been playing with the idea that there was a world controlled by forces that most people, even people under the thumb of those forces, were unaware of, and that, you know, you had to be a believer in order to grasp exactly what was going on. The X-Files had been, I think, around for 5 or 6 seasons. The first movie had already come out. So that idea was really ready to be kind of more fully explored in a movie, and I think The Matrix did that.
Yeah, yeah. You described The Matrix as an elaborate, wordy, barely comprehensible piece of world building. Can you explain why it doesn't do a very good job of building its own world?
You know, I'm not sure that it doesn't do a good job. In some ways, you could argue that the sequels almost do too good a job, that they're more about world building and establishing their rules than about forward motion. But I think one thing that's very shrewd about the world building in The Matrix is that because it's kind of nonspecific in the first movie, it can appeal to anyone. If there's an ideology to The Matrix, it's basically anti-establishment or anti-control. It says some force is running the show. The force that's running the show is malevolent and does not wish you well. The only way that you're going to overthrow that is by becoming aware of it. And that, as far as kind of dystopian world building goes, is about as one size fits all as you can get. I mean, and I think that's one reason that, that Matrix thinking has kind of permeated the culture, that that idea, take the red pill, has become in some ways a rallying cry of the alt-right, but the structure that the Matrix creates can be appropriated just as easily by libertarians, because it's really about the primacy of the individual, or by people on the left who could take it as an anti-corporate metaphor.
Yeah.
So The Matrix has never excluded anyone from enjoying it on ideological grounds.
Yeah, it's very malleable. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. You argue in your story that The Matrix didn't anticipate our world, but that it anticipated and probably created a new way of viewing that world. How was it able to accomplish this?
It's really interesting. When you are talking about a piece of influential pop culture, you always have to ask, was it prescient or did it just get lucky? Mm. And I think the answer is almost always both. I mean, The Matrix did not create the world we're in, but it was one of the first movies to feature what I think of as a stay-at-home hero.
Something wrong, man? You look a little whiter than usual.
My computer, you ever have that feeling where you're not sure if you're awake or still dreaming?
All the time. Hey. Look, it just sounds to me like, you know, you need to unplug, man. You know, get some R&R.
The two things it didn't anticipate, or maybe it was smart enough to guess before the rest of us knew, are, one, a world where we would all be sitting in front of screens all the time, and two, a world in which all information would come to us through those screens, and that we in turn would spit our little piece of information back out into those screens via social media. You know, if The Matrix was smart enough to understand that we were all going to be looking at the world through laptops at some point, that's really impressive. And I think it's a reason that it still seems relevant to a lot of people.
And it seems like the Morpheus quote.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
That seems to have really resonated and become part of our common language. I Googled it yesterday and got 219 million results. How do you see that phrase playing out in our society today?
Well, I think everybody's absolute belief in their own righteousness is not something that the Matrix invented, but it's something that is hugely magnified by social media, where everyone is an evangelist for something, whether it's, you know, a movie that they like or an episode of a TV show that they hate or an entire ideology.
Your appearance now is what we call residual self-image. It is the mental projection of your digital self.
It's a very strange thing for people to have followers. That's a really strange way to view yourself. And even though it's become second nature to us, there's something creepy about a social media system in which everyone is a potential prophet. And I think, again, The Matrix didn't create that, but the world that followed The Matrix made the kind of language that is used in The Matrix a really good fit for social media.
Yeah, yeah, that's very much the case. Yeah, I was very intrigued by your statement that The Matrix is in every single everything you know about X is wrong story. Can you tell me about that?
Right. Well, I think it's a funny thing. This was something my editor for the piece pointed out to me, and I think he was very smart about it, that, you know, you can write a story about how to boil an egg, And you could headline it, here's a foolproof way to make sure your hard-boiled egg comes out right every time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or here are the best instructions for hard-boiling an egg you've ever seen. But today, 2019, the headline would most naturally be, you've been boiling eggs wrong your whole life.
Exactly, yeah.
And for sure. And that whole thing that, like, there is something right in front of you, even the idea of life hacks that has become so popular in the last few years, the idea that everything in life is a code to be cracked and that it's almost pleasurable. I think people enjoy it. They don't feel insulted when they see a headline saying you've been doing such and such wrong your whole life. They feel like suddenly their life is an interesting puzzle or a mystery that is solvable.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin.
Journalist Mark Harris is the author of the New York Magazine cover story, The Matrix Built Our Reality-Denying World. Find out more about Mark and The Matrix at WPR.org/beta.
Anytime I start talking about my mother, I'm like likely to break into tears, but she's the person that introduced me to this music, and to me, it's her culture.
Madison's country music scholar Bill Malone joins us. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome back to Beta. I'm Doug Gordon. When Ken Burns went looking for a country music expert, he looked no further than Wisconsin's Bill Malone. He's the author of Country Music USA. Bill's with us now to talk about his lifelong passion. Bill, you say that you were born into country music. How so?
Well, it's the first music I ever heard. I like to think that the music my mother sang was country music. She didn't know where it came from. Some of it came from the church. She was an ardent Pentecostal, and she poured out her heart in music. Songs like Farther Along and We'll Understand It Better By and By. That was a way of coping with a semi-isolated existence on a East Texas cotton farm. So I heard her singing, and I knew how much that music meant to her, and it rubbed off on me. And then, of course, in 1939, Daddy came in with a Philco battery-powered radio. But as far as my life's work was concerned, although I didn't realize it at the time, it introduced me to what I call the radio hillbillies, the country musicians who came to us from radio stations in Dallas and Fort Worth, Tyler, Shreveport, Tulsa, and eventually from Nashville over the Grand Ole Opry. And so I grew up listening to those people. It's kind of an unusual paradox the way I looked at them. In one sense, I thought of them as being exotic beings, you know, because they sang about the Texas plains and the southern mountains and about lonely hobos. It seemed like a world far from what we were experiencing. But at the same time, they also seemed like they could be brothers or cousins. They sounded like us, and they went out of their way to create a family feeling. They made us think that we were part of the family. When they offered their picture songbooks for sale, we bought them. If they suggested a certain product that we ought to buy, we'd buy it. But above all, we listened to their music, and so I never realized that the music I love could be the basis for an academic study.
Yeah.
And it became that at the University of Texas at Austin.
Do you remember some of the first artists you heard on the old Philco radio? Some particular songs that really resonated with you?
One song in particular will always be a cherished memory. It was one called The Last Letter. People still sing that today. But we heard a man named Rex Griffin singing it. Rex was like so many of the country musicians at that time. He was an itinerant. He moved from one radio station to another until the territory was played out, as they called it. Then he would move on to another station. But we had a guitar. My older brother worked real hard for a neighbor to get a real cheap, probably a Sears Roebuck guitar. He started learning a few chords on it. And then my next brother, who's still alive, he picked it up too. And by the time I came along, I was 8 years younger than they were. And when I started playing the guitar, I made it a point to learn on that same song, The Last Letter, with my mother sitting by, you know, and give me encouragement, telling me when I needed to change chords. I said, oh, you got to change there, Billy, you know.
Why do you treat me as if I were only a friend? What have I done that has made you so different and cold? Sometimes I wonder if you'll be contented again. Will you be happy when you are withered and old?
So, yeah, you got yourself a guitar. You used your brother's guitar, as you said. And then at some point you started singing at bars and parties,
yeah.
Right? What songs did you sing?
Okay, well, I sang all my life.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to the University of Texas in 1954, I went down as a junior, and I became kind of notorious for, you know, I was singing all the time. I'd sing walking down the halls and just sitting in the office or just humming a song.
Sure.
But then some of my friends, about the time we entered graduate school, we began singing at parties, and then we went out to this now famous bar in North Austin called Threadgill's. And I remember very well around 1962 probably, a little group from the University of Texas Folk Music Club came out too. They heard that there was music out there. And among the people who came out was Janis Joplin.
Huh.
At that time, she was strumming an auto harp and singing with a little group called the Waller Creek Boys.
Mm.
But she, of course, it's easy to see from the very beginning that she had a voice that surpassed any that we had. And she wasn't there very long until she went to California and became the great rock star that she was.
Well, one side is the life of a millionaire.
And while I was at the University of Texas, one day I was just browsing in the Austin Public Library, or one of its branches, and I came across a boxed collection of what was described on the cover as folk music. It turned out to be a part of the great collection that Harry Smith had been collecting
for
years.
Yeah.
And it was called the Anthology of American Folk Music.
Sure.
I was really bowled over by it, but for one thing, it introduced me to people I had not heard before, like Charlie Poole and Blind Willie Johnson and Blind Lemons, on and on. I'm convinced that's the single most important folk music recording ever made.
You tell me who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
John the Revelator.
Who's that riding?
And it was also a turning point in my career. It gave a kind of a validity, a kind of a sanction for what I'd been singing and now was beginning to treat as an academic exercise.
Yeah, so let's talk about that, how that the academic exercise, as you call it, how that came about. You were at the University of Texas at Austin. This was, I think, 1954 is when you enrolled, and then you had this life-changing moment in 1960. Can you tell me about that?
I got all three of my degrees at UT Austin. I had no earthly idea about what I wanted to write about. And my supervising professor was a fellow named Joe Franz. One day, I took a trip with him and a couple of other graduate students down to Houston to watch the Texas Longhorns play in the Bluebonnet Bowl against Alabama. And we sang all the way down there. And then at dinner time, I believe it was that first evening, just out of the blue, Dr. Franz said, "Well, you know, you love this music so much. Why don't you write a history of Nashville publishing?" And I thought, "You mean you can actually write on something you love? That's unheard of." So I got into the subject and wrote not just a history of Nashville public, but a general history of the entire phenomenon. Country music, I tackled its folk music beginnings before commercialization. Then I picked up with radio and recording and talked about how it evolved over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way Country Music USA came about.
I'm curious about how did performing country music, playing it and singing it, how did that influence the way you wrote about country music?
I think it helped me to understand where the music came from. It helped me to understand what it meant to people because I knew what it had meant to my own family. And so I think I had an understanding that people coming from outside might not have had. On the other hand, it probably made me blind to certain features of the music. At first, I didn't realize just how nativist and jingoistic it could be. And I don't think people thought much about that at the time. I didn't realize just how neglected women had been. Women were part of the music from the time it was commercialized, but they were generally made to feel subordinate to the men in the business. And of course, I didn't really realize just how eclectic, how broad-based the music was at the time, just how strongly African-American culture had touched the music from the beginning and how it continued to do so throughout its history.
Well, can you get a man? But now she's gone. I don't worry, I'm sitting on top of the world.
Your dissertation was published in 1968 as the book Country Music USA, which is considered by many to be the Bible of country music. What were you trying to do? What were you trying to accomplish when you wrote it?
I felt like that the general history needed to be told quickly, because I wasn't sure what was going to happen to this music, because rock and roll had come along first with Elvis in 1954, and then the record companies, one after another, began looking for people who could who sounded like Elvis, and the performers themselves began to change their styles and adapt them to also to meet the needs of this new youth audience that was becoming paramount in the United States. Because there was a period of time there when traditional country music, as I knew it, virtually disappeared from the jukeboxes and from the radio DJ shows. You couldn't hear a fiddle or a steel guitar. And I want to tell the story of this music, well, it needs to be told, and when there are still people around who can tell me the story.
You've been married to your wife, Bobby, for more than 40 years, I think, right?
About 42.
Yeah. How did you meet her?
I met her in a honky-tonk.
How appropriate, yeah.
What kind of music do you usually have here?
Oh, we got both kinds. We got country and western.
I had a band in New Orleans, a bluegrass band called the Hill Country Ramblers. And one evening, she came out to the bar with a colleague of mine from the history department, and she came in and sat on the front row, and she'll tell you, and I agree, that was love at first sight. She was just fascinated by this guy up on the stage, this professor who was singing these honky-tonk songs. And of course, I was fascinated by her. Big smile and bright eyes. And so,
do you remember what song you were playing when you
I was singing,
saw each other?
Driving Nails in My Coffin.
Yeah, it's an Ernest Tubbs song, right?
Yeah.
I'm just driving nails in my coffin. Every time I drink a bottle of booze, I'm just driving nails in my coffin. Lordy, driving those nails over you.
And she learned that I had a mandolin in the closet. She wanted to be part of what I was doing. See, we got the mandolin out of the closet, and a friend taught her a few chords on it. And we did our first show at a Presbyterian church on St. Charles. I was doing a kind of a history of gospel music, how it evolved over the years. And in the middle of one song, you know, she forgot the words. And she went in the back room, and when I got back there, she was crying. She said, I'll never try to play again. I said, yes, you are. We're going to start playing at a coffee house. We're going to play every week, and you're going to get over your stage fright, and we're going to learn how to play. So we've been trying to do it ever since.
I want to ask you about one of the all-time country greats, George Jones, who has been described as the Frank Sinatra of country music. What's your take on Jones?
I think he's the greatest singer country music ever had.
Yeah.
He might be as good as anybody in the pop ranks of any type.
Do you have a favorite George Jones song?
The Grand Tour.
Yeah, that's a classic, yeah.
I get off, get almost get swallowed up by the instrumentation, but he puts his heart and soul into it. You can feel his anguish, and I think that's the mark of a great country singer. He or she can make you think that the song is written specially for you. See, I understand what you're going through because I've gone through it too.
There's her rings, all her things, and her clothes are in the closet. Like she left them when she tore my world apart.
Who are the most influential women in the history of country music?
Kitty Wells has to be toward the top.
Yeah.
Because this unassuming and just as non-threatening as any woman could be, but yet was singing songs like "It Wasn't God Who Made Honky Tonk Angels." And I think she gave encouragement to other women to sing. So she influenced a lot of the women who came along in the early and mid-1950s. Of course, then Patsy Cline.
Yeah.
Patsy Cline was such a great singer that she quickly lost identification as a country singer.
Yeah, she transcended country and became known in the pop circles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of interesting because when she started out, she wanted to do straight country. She wanted to dress like a cowgirl, which she did. And she resisted at first some of the songs that became big hits for her. But when they did, and today, you know, go almost anywhere in the country, restaurant or supper club, and in the background, you can hear some Patsy Cline being sung.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry.
What do you think of today's contemporary country music?
Well, when I want to listen to country music, I generally pull out my CDs and old records.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm still looking for old-time songs that I haven't heard lately or never have heard. And in today's scene, I look for people who don't necessarily imitate the past, but they build upon it.
Yeah.
They have a sense of roots. They seem to have a reverence for the working class roots of the music. And then they take that and go and make their own sound. I'm referring to people like Tim O'Brien,
yeah,
who I think is the most versatile
person
out there today playing.
Yeah.
Iris DeMent.
Oh, yeah. She's great, yeah.
Everybody is wondering what and where they all came from. Everybody is worrying about where they're going to go when the whole thing's done. But no one knows for certain, and so it's all the same to me. Let the mystery be.
You've been working with Ken Burns on this new documentary series about country music that's scheduled to air in the fall. Can you tell me about what that experience has been like working with Ken?
Oh, it's wonderful. I've for a few years now, I've been a consultant to the Ken Burns program. I read scripts and critique them and send them back. And then I believe it was in 2014, I went to New York and was interviewed for 2 or 3 hours. So they asked me questions spanning the entire history of country music.
Right. So you're going to show up as one of the talking heads in the documentary.
Yeah. And we last October of last year, I guess it was, we went to Walpole, New Hampshire, and sat down and watched the pre-screening. It was just a wonderful experience to, I think almost everybody was tearful by the time it was over.
Yeah.
You know, for one thing, to think of all the people that you see on the screen who have died since the filming began. And in my case, you know, I was tearful because I remember any time I start talking about my mother, I'm like likely to break into tears. But she's the person that introduced me to this music, and it, to me, it's her culture. And I'm just pleased that I'm able to keep it alive and to document it and to commemorate it. So I felt, as I watched the Ken Burns screening, I felt this is a validation of my life's work and of the music that I've always loved.
Bill Malone is the author of Country Music USA. You can see him in Ken Burns' documentary, Country Music. You can find out more at WPR.org/beta.
When I started comedy, any images of Muslims that I saw on TV or media or, you know, there was a fear. So I have to give them another alternative to this identity.
That's comedian Zainab Johnson. She'll join us next when Beta returns on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta.
My New Year's resolution was to stop being late. You know what they say, black people are always late. Said, I'm gonna stop being late. The thing is, though, when you start showing up on time, you notice when everybody else is late. My one homegirl, she's disrespectfully late. She was like, Zainab, you don't get it. The reason why I always am late is because I need more time to do my hair. I said, cool. Thing is, though, her hair don't never look good. So now every time she walks in late, I'm like, you could have been on time. You could have been on time.
That's comedian Zainab Johnson. Zainab grew up in Harlem, one of 13 children in a Muslim family. When she was 17, she was hit by a truck driven by a drunk driver. Zainab spent a year and a half in the hospital, learning to walk again. She talks about how that experience shaped her life.
Something like that happening at that age is really traumatic, and it, one, makes you very grateful to be spared, in the very least, but also it made me, like, really look within. I think when I was a teenager, I was, like, coming into myself. I don't know if you know this, but I grew up Muslim, and I always covered up.
Yeah.
And then maybe around 15, I started to not cover up. And I think I was exploring, like, who I was as a young woman in the world.
Yeah.
And trying to fit in and be popular and all of those things. And I think being hit by the truck, I think it did two things. One, it made me really, like, just make sure that what's in me has a strong foundation.
Mm.
And it also, I don't know, it made me really compassionate.
Yeah.
It made me really compassionate because there was another woman who was also pushing the back of the car with me, and her leg was amputated.
Oh, dear.
And so while I was laying there in the hospital, just in all of my vanity, like, oh, my God, this can't be happening to me. Somebody get me a plastic surgery. I remember, like, I had these, like, you know, gashes on my face, and some of my teeth were chipped, and, you know, and I was like, somebody make me look like I used to look, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then my friend hopped in on crutches, missing one leg. And I was like, it's the first time I ever thought, like, oh, there's always somebody worse off.
Yeah.
And not that you need to think about somebody being worse off to, like, appreciate your life, but it really does put things in perspective.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You went on to earn a mathematics degree, and then for a while you were working as a teacher. Why did you decide to give that up to pursue a career in stand-up?
My parents went to college but hadn't finished, and I just had it set in my mind that I was going to be the next generation that did something at least a little bit better, you know?
Uh-huh.
And so I was dead set on at least getting a degree, and math was something that I had always been good at, and some of the positive role models in my life were teachers. And so it just made sense to me to go into that direction, and actually, a friend of mine who had finished college maybe a year before I did, she was like, I'm moving to L.A. to be a famous actress. And I was like, oh, she can't be famous without me. And I just, you know, that same year, my dad had passed away. And
I'm
it was
sorry.
just another, like, reminder, like, you know, time is of the essence, no regrets. Like, what are my intentions in this life? What am I seeking? What, you know, what's my legacy? What am I looking to do? And I'm not sure if later in life I'll become a teacher in a classroom, or maybe through comedy or some other platform I'll be teaching in other ways. But I just knew that wasn't what I was supposed to be doing at that time.
Yeah. Well, I think you are. I think it's fair to say that you are doing some teaching already with, you know, a lot of the content of your stand-up, I think.
I hope so.
Oh, I think you're doing it.
I hope so. I mean, it does feel better when people can take something of substance away from my act.
Yay! Yay, yay, yay! Give it up for my afro! It excites me because I had a shaved head for 7 years. I was never late anywhere. When I started growing it back, my friend was like, Zainab, I didn't know your hair grew like that. I was like what? I tried to lead her down a racism trap. I was like, how does my hair grow? She was like, you know, it's tight and coarse. I was like, oh, no, that's the misconception. My hair grows very straight. Then I walk out into the world and oppression makes it tight and coarse.
You grew up in Harlem as one of 13 siblings in a Muslim family. How has this life experience shaped your comedy?
I don't know if being Muslim has shaped my comedy. I mean, I talk about it. Mm-hmm. And for a very long time, I hated being Muslim. And not the actual belief of it, mm-hmm. just the practice of it. It can be a very, like all religions, but I think more so it can just appear to be more strict. Mm-hmm. And there were certain things in the practice of Islam that just was a major inconvenience in my life as a kid, you mm-hmm. know?
Yeah.
And it immediately set me apart from everybody else. And I didn't like that. And so I wanted to be as far away from Islam as possible. But while I was in college, I took an elective course. It was the history of religion, and it opened my eyes up to a lot of things that I just wasn't taught and didn't know, not only about Islam, but about Christianity, about Judaism, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that put me back in, that had me sort of seek, okay, like, what do I believe? What do I stand for? And then it made me sort of research where my faith lied, mm-hmm. and I became proud of it.
Mm, yeah.
And then when I started, there's always been, like, a negative rhetoric regarding Islam in this country specifically and across the world. And I just felt like when I started comedy, any images of Muslims that I saw on TV or in media or, you know, there was a fear there. Mm. You know, I was in New York when 9/11 happened. Mm. And there was just a fear of Muslims there. And I was like, wow, well, I'm a Muslim and I don't want people to fear me. I don't want people to think that I have these same beliefs. So I have to give them another alternative to this identity. Mm-hmm. And so that's the way my faith influences my comedy. In terms of being one of 13, I think there's a certain aspect of that you of being a part of a group where you can't, you don't stand, you know, like I had to share everything. I think maybe I chose stand up because I stand there alone.
Mm.
And it's just me. And it's like, all if there's glory, I get all the glory. If I fail, I fail alone. You know, like mm-hmm. I think that may be the subconscious thing about stand up that appeals to me.
Yeah, it's all independent and it's all on you. Success or failure, it's all, and you have total creative control over what you're doing.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that makes sense. What do you think it is that makes your comedy different, your stand up comedy different from other comedians' work?
I think I know my voice. Mm-hmm. And I think that is an asset. Like I know comedians spend years trying to find their voice. You'll hear, like, you know, some respected person in comedy say to a younger comedian, like, you know, when you find your voice, you'll be great. And I think that I found my voice early.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was just like, this is who I am.
Yeah.
And You're either like me and you're going to identify with who I am because I'm a reflection of you, or I'm completely different and you are going to enjoy the journey of exploring somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in my sets, a lot of times there's tension.
Yeah.
And then I'll break the tension with the joke.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's kind of who I am in real life too, and I just try and bring exactly who I am in real life to the stage.
13 of us, 7 brothers, 5 sisters, and it's all from the same mother and father, and I brag about that. Yeah. Yeah. You know, like, that's the thing that made me feel like I was winning. When things wasn't going my way, that was the thing that I felt like I had over people, you know? Like, kids would come up to me in school and be like, Zainab, did you get an A on a test? I'd be like, no. But I know my father. I come from a 2-parent home. What are the odds? I used it the other day. My homegirl, she was too happy. She was like, Zaynab, he put a ring on it. Oh my God, he loves me. I was like, oh my God, you're getting married. That's so great, but who's gonna walk you down the aisle?
You mentioned that you found your comedic voice early on in your career. Do you think your comedic voice has evolved over the 10 years that you've been doing stand-up? Has it changed in any way?
I think I've gotten more comfortable in silence. Mm. I actually, if you, you know, watch any of my longer sets, I revel in the silence.
Yeah, yeah.
In a room. And I think most comedians are afraid of that, especially a comedian that's only been doing it for 8 years like me, you know? Like, mm-hmm. I think that's not the comfort place for most comedians, but that's where I find my comfort, when the crowd is completely silent.
Mm, yes, and silence can be very powerful, especially, as you say, in stand-up, where a lot of comedians most probably are afraid of silence.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to have a whole 45-minute show of people just being dead silent.
No, that's for Marcel Marceau and mimes. Yeah, that's for them. But yeah, but no, but you use it. No, I know exactly what you mean. You use it very powerfully. Yeah, besides your stand-up work, you also have your own podcast, which is called Honest Tea with Z. And Honest Tea is spelled H-O-N-E-S, capital T, capital E, capital A. Can you mm-hmm. tell me a bit about your podcast and why you do it?
Absolutely. It's another way for the people who are interested in my comedy or my point of view to connect with me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I'll be in Minnesota or Philadelphia or wherever, and you get to see me, and then for a whole nother year, you don't get to see me. And so this is a way for them to sort of directly connect with not only what's going on in the world, but what's going on in the world through my point of view. Welcome to Honest Tea with me, long time no Z, right? Been gone for a minute, now I'm back to jump off. To the listeners that hit me like, hey girl, with all due respect, when are you putting out another episode? Thank you for holding me accountable and letting me know that you guys miss me when I'm gone, and I do apologize. The title came from... I was in a car with two other female comedians in New York, and one was asking for advice. And I'm typically like the bottom line person. Like I can wrap it in like comfort, but I'm going to tell you the truth.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'm going to give you what is facts.
Yeah.
And so my friend was asking for advice, and I just broke it down. Like I bought it, and she was like, "Okay, Honest Tea with Z." And I was like, "Oh my God, I think that's the title of this podcast that I want to do." And I wanted to create a space where I could chat with my audience about things that may or may not be true, things that we're hearing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this whole like fake news phenomena.
Oh yeah.
And then I also wanted to give some factual information too. But it's all like in line with my comedy, which is all a conversation.
The description of your podcast on the homepage says that you're discussing your own personal experiences as well as newsworthy stories, and nothing is off limits, which raises a question in my mind. Is there anything that is off limits in your stand-up comedy?
No. The only thing that's off limits in my stand-up comedy is me foregoing who I am for the sake of something funny.
Okay, yeah. Do you have a favorite joke that you're most proud of?
Yeah, I have a few. I think the joke that I enjoy telling any jokes that have to do with my family.
I grew up in a house with married parents, so I want to be married. I really want to be married, but I feel a pressure to marry a black guy. I really do. Of all my siblings, five of them are married. None of them have married a black person. Like, we were so happy when my brother started dating a black girl, we didn't care that he was cheating on his wife. I found out later she was Dominican. I was like, we'll take it. We'll take it.
I really like that joke because it's so unexpected.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just so unexpected. And most recently, I really like the joke about me trying to figure out if my brother was gay.
Yes.
You know, the journal joke. I love that joke.
It's 13 of us. Somebody should be gay, right? Statistically. They say one in every five Americans is gay. It's 13 of us. We should have two and a half. Like two and a bisexual, right? My younger brother, he was a good suspect. I stole his journal because I was like, I'm gonna crack this case. I was like, the information is in his journal. All I have to do is find it. We'll invite him out the closet. So I read his journal, come to find out he's in love with this girl. I was pissed. I confronted him. I'm like, what is this? He said, Zainab, you read my journal? I was like, you're not gay. You have a journal.
Zainab Johnson is a stand-up comedian and podcast host. You can find out more about Zainab at wpr.org/beta. That's all for this week's beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at wprbeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions. Special thanks to guest producer Carl Christensen.
He is considered by many authorities to be the most dangerous man alive.
Our technical and music director is Steve Gotcher.
You believe that you are special, that somehow the rules do not apply to you.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Why, oh, why didn't I take the blue pill?
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
He is the one.
What do you say to something like that?